even though if you didn't, if you weren't here last week or didn't go over it, it still can be viewed as an independent area as well, but it's helpful. I want to contrast two stories in Bereshit, two incidents which seem to be very similar. It would help me if somebody could give a brief summary of what we did last week. Well, this was the story of Abraham and Sarah when they went into the land of Egypt. So Abraham was afraid because Sarah was an exceedingly beautiful woman. And the Egyptians were a people that were not in a very high level of morality, especially with regard to strangers. So he feared that they would take his wife and they would kill him. So he made up this, with her permission, he made up this story that she was his sister. He asked her to say that she was his sister. And this way they would not kill him. And what happened was she was taken to the house of Pharaoh, because everybody that saw her regarded her as a beautiful woman, and she was very much praised to Pharaoh. Pharaoh took her, wanting to take her as a wife. But then God brought plague. God brought plague upon the house of Pharaoh. And Pharaoh understood that this was something unusual. As he said, he was a superstitious type of a person. And he discovered that the truth was that she was really his wife. And this was God's way of saving her. So God intervened with miracles, brought plagues upon the house of Pharaoh. And by doing so, Pharaoh was saved. And then Pharaoh, in anger, turned to Abraham and asked him, why did you do this to me? Why don't you tell me the truth? And that's where we left off. Well, we analyzed the nature of the society. And we said that the way God acted towards the society was based upon the nature of that society. It was basically a society which functioned on the instinctual level. They lived in accordance with their instincts. And at the same time, they did have somewhat of a conscience. And we tried to explain that even low-life kind of people, I can compare it to the mafia, for example, they too live based on instinctual types of existence, but at the same time they follow a certain code. They do have their own code of ethics amongst themselves. And so too Egypt did have a code of ethics. And at the same time, they're also very superstitious kind of people. It happens to be very true. The more you study about gangsters, these types of people, you will see they're extremely superstitious. Did I see it yet? The point of it is, though, that it is ironic that these people who pose as being so tough and so strong, and also they don't seem to be afraid of God or divine retribution, at the same time are very, very superstitious. And I wouldn't mind pausing for a second to define, because the Torah is very much against superstition. I don't know if anybody knows about this, but the Torah is very much against, no, seriously, because people take superstition lightly. They think it's, you know, like if they say, well, how are you doing? You're going to knock on wood, right? Or if the salt shaker, you know, or you won't step over somebody because you won't grow, or some people won't walk under a ladder. And people think that these are very harmless kind of things. I'm sorry? Well, what about it? That's a good question. We'll have to take that up separately. Alright? I'm just looking to take superstition per se. Now, most people think that it's rather harmless. According to the Torah, however, it's a biblical violation to engage in superstition. I'm sorry? Well, divination. Yeah, divination. To go to a fortune teller. If a person goes to a fortune teller, or people that read their palm readers, what is that called, where they're looking through those Ouija boards, what else is there? All these different things, or for example, if a person, astrology charts, like Reagan had, people write he wouldn't make appointments. If a person does something or desists from doing something because it's a bad day, this is not my good day, lucky day. All of these different things I'm talking to you about are considered to be idolatry, according to the reason. Somebody asked me that question, by the way. So what do we mean when we say mazel tov to somebody? Now, mazel tov, that question just was asked of me recently. Let me just explain why. What is wrong with all these things? What is wrong with not doing something? This is not my lucky day. What is wrong with any one of these superstitions that a person believes in? Yes, Lori? More than it's true on the personal, you're explaining it from the psychological, but it is a denial of God. Because a person who has true faith and conviction in God believes that everything that occurs in this world is a result of the universe that God has created, which functions in accordance with natural law, and it's a result of God's will, because sometimes God intervenes, so to speak. Sometimes it's not a natural result of the... That's what we call... Okay, I want to just go over this quickly. So you understand that if a person believes that everything in the universe is a result of God's will, or not necessarily God's specific intention. We don't mean to say, therefore, that every particular event that occurs is a result of God's specific will for you. It could be a result of the natural law. What people call chance is not chance. It's the natural law. God has designed the natural law. Therefore, when a person does an action which indicates that there are other forces operating out there, that's idolatry. Why are you doing this? Because if I do this action, then there's some force out there that will protect me. So, no matter how trivial it may seem to a person, if he's doing it, it means it has psychological significance to him. And therefore, it's a denial of God. And he's trying to propitiate, to try and... I'll ask that person, do you believe that everything happens as a result of God? And therefore, if you've acted correctly in terms of the Torah, so then what harm can come to you? Well, if harm is going to come to you, then the only way you can change that is by going back to God. I mean, if you sin, then repent. But the person is saying that, no, he's done everything according to God's dictate or God's command, and yet he still feels that if he'll do certain actions, like he'll have a rabbit's foot, then that'll give him a foot. What do you mean? Where does it say in the Torah that a rabbit's foot is going to protect you? So you're creating your own system. Which means to say that you believe that there are forces out there that have control over your destiny. Well, that's the essence of idolatry. So therefore, if a person does practice these things, they should review them and they should analyze them. The second thing, I think, is what Laurie is saying. The reason it strikes me as being interesting that people that on the surface seem so irreligious, like the mafioso type, should be so superstitious. Now, how do you fit that in? How do you understand that phenomenon? Why are these people who seem so macho and so tough and so fearless, why are they the people that are extremely, extremely afraid of spirits and superstitions? And I once saw one time in this guy delivered something. This is many, many years ago, going back a long time now, but somebody delivered something to the house. He was, it wasn't Jewish, a big husky, tough looking guy, and he was asking about those funny things on the wall, the mezuzah. So what is that? So I explained, that there's a scroll inside with a portion from the Torah, and he said, of course, he saw he had moved into a house and they were on the wall. Obviously, he had rented it, a Jew had lived there before. And he said he didn't know what it was, but he thought it had something to do with religion, so he didn't take it down. He says, I don't mess with those kind of things. He ain't taking any chances, So, right. That's the Ayin Hara. Yeah, that's my Ayin Hara here. I'll come back to that. I'm not going to go on to that. Why is it then that these seemingly tough individuals, godless people, to be a mafia, God, at the same time, are really so steep. They have these silver, jewelry, and charms, and chains, and they do their Hail Marys, and whatever it is they do. So, what's the deal over here? What's the deal? Anybody? Explain it to me. Oh, I don't understand the phenomenon. And they happen to be true. In other words, the superstition is, from the psychological level, is a form of cowardice. It's rooted in human weakness and insecurity, a coward. A person that, no matter how tough, it could be a cover. Their toughness, their macho, and all that is a cover for insecurity. A person That's why we read about Abraham, that once he discovered the true ideas, he smashed the idols. To demonstrate that there's nothing to be afraid of. And a person that practices these superstitions is captive to his infantile fears. Children are very much given to these kinds of things. They work at all these little rituals. And before they go to sleep, they were cracking the sidewalk. Well, I think before they go to sleep, the pillow has to be a certain way, and the cover, and this and that. It's all the carryover. Well, children, I can understand that that's part of the infantile security, the infantile mentality. But when what happens is that when a person, and they're afraid of the dark, but all these forces are much more effective in the dark, apparently. You put the light on, or sleeping in a house all by yourself and there's nobody else there. Yeah. Well, you see, there's nothing. Rachel's there. But if Rachel's there, you're not afraid. Because you're not alone. Even though it wasn't Rachel there, right? You can definitely do it with Rachel. Well, Michal, you have nothing to worry about, right? Are you not afraid of that? So, therefore, for all the. These are basically. These are bullies. And bullies are basically cowards. And that fits in with the. The real essence of the personality is to be found in the clinging to superstition. A truly courageous person would not have any superstition. So if you discover that in an individual, you pointed out, then first of all, because it's denial of God. A person who has true faith in God fears no other forces. He fears God. And he fears God in the proper way. I mean, we haven't discussed the true idea of the fear of God. We discussed it in the past. Now, that's why when God dealt with Pharaoh, all he wanted to do was to cause Pharaoh to give gorge, so to speak, to give up Pharaoh. And therefore he chose to hit him in his most vulnerable way, to scare him to death, to do something which he would do in a very superstitious manner. Because according to the way Rashi learns, his objective was sexual desire, and such a beautiful woman, and he was smitten with a sexual play. And therefore he was unable to fulfill his desire, but things happened in such a way that it affected his superstitious mode of thinking. He tied the events together. And because of that superstitious mode of thinking, he came to the realization that he was doing a sin. And that's why he gave Abraham an argument. He gave him an argument because he had to pose as a righteous man. And he wants, rather than blame himself, he had to blame it on Abraham. And then he sent him away with a guard to protect him so that nothing would happen to him and Sarah, because he was afraid that this man had special protection. As they say, he'll protect you. Okay. Now, the next story we take up is the story of, this is the background. That's the story of Abraham and Sarah in Egypt. Now, let's turn to, it starts in chapter 20. And chapter 20 in Genesis, you love it, please. And Abraham traveled from there to the land of the Negev. The Negev is the southern part of Israel, which leads into the Sinai. Vayesh is in Kadesh of Ein Shur, and he dwelt between Kadesh and Shur. Vayogar v'Gror, and he stayed in Gror. And Abraham said about Sarah, his wife, that she is my sister. So here, again, he's in a strange land, and he's utilizing the same strategy. He's referring to her as a sister. And Abimelech, the king of Gerar, sent for her and took Sarah. And took Sarah. And the Ramban points out one difference over here. And that is that here we don't find that the ministers of Abimelech raised her to him. It wasn't as it was in Egypt. There was a whole system set up. Remember we said he had set up the whole system that they should spot out the beautiful woman and report back to Pharaoh. Apparently he just found out about her. And he took her. Okay, fine. Now what happened? Then God came to Abimelech in a dream of the night, which means a prophetic dream.
By Yom Erlo, and God said to him, behold, you're going to die because of the woman that you've taken, and she is a married woman. And Abimelech had not approached her. That means he had not had relations with her. As we'll find out later on, again, it was because God had intervened to prevent him from doing so. And he said, Lord, will you also kill a righteous nation? Now, not all of you have Rashi, but Rashi makes some very interesting comments, and I'm going to read them to you to give you an idea of what the Rashi's interpretation is. Rashi says he had not approached her. He says an angel prevented him from doing that. An angel means a force that is created by God. Then he says on the question, will you, a nation which is also righteous, will you kill? So Rashi explains like this. What do you mean also righteous? That is to say that it's sort of like a complaint. Are you going to kill a righteous nation or a righteous nation also? As though there's some complaints here about God's justice. So he says, even if it is righteous, will you kill him? Maybe that's your way, to destroy nations for nothing. That's what you did to the generation of the flood and to the generation of the dispersion, that's the Tower of Babel. So too do I say that you kill them for nothing, just like you're about to kill me. So there's an implication of a complaint. This is Rashi, by the way. This is not the text. This is Rashi. But the way Rashi is learning the words, it's a medrash. It's a medrash. No, it's a medrash. It's not Rashi's own. But that doesn't really matter. Rashi is saying that Avimelech was, in a very subtle way, complaining about God's justice. Are you going to kill me also, just like you killed the generation of the flood for no reason? He was a defender of the generation of the flood. All right, let's bear this in mind, because we're going to try and form a picture of this society. Let's go back to the text, though. Because in the text, you see there's a difference between the remarks. Rashi is making these cutting remarks about Avimelech, but in the text is portraying Avimelech as being a decent type of a chap. It's hard to understand the story. And Avimelech had not approached her. And he said, I read that a bit. Let's go to the next one. Then he continues his argument. But he said to me, she's my sister, meaning Abraham. And she too said to me, he is my brother. With innocence of heart and a clean and clean hands did I do this. With innocence of heart and clean hands. In other words, I'm totally innocent. He's engaging in a debate with God. He's defending himself. How am I supposed? What did I do wrong? He said, my sister. She said, he's my brother. What did I do wrong? And Rashi adds over here too, because the word gam also implies that there's something more here. So Rashi says, gam he, she too, to include the servants and the ones who were driving the animals and so forth, their entire entourage. They traveled with a big entourage. They were big, you know, for many people. Abraham and Sarah had a big following, much property and so forth. So they not only did they say this, but the entire group said it. They all said it. So what did they do? And God said to him in the dream, I too know that with innocence of heart you did this. And therefore I have prevented you, I've stopped you from sinning to me. Therefore, I did not permit you to touch her. All right. Avimelech seems to be acting in innocence. What did he do wrong? And God over here concedes his point. God seems to be, yes, somewhat, but God is basically conceding his point. And says, I know too. I know very well that you acted with innocence of heart. And because of this, I have prevented you from touching her. So I'm doing you a favor, in other words. And now he says, return the wife of the man, for he is a prophet. And he shall pray for you, and you'll live. And if you don't return, know that you will certainly die, you and all that belongs to you. That was the end of the dream. Quite a message. Let me just read through the story, then we'll analyze it. So, Avimelech got up early in the morning. We can understand that. I don't think he needed an alarm clock that morning. He got up early in the morning, and he called his servants, and he discussed all of these words with them. And they were very much afraid. So apparently the message got through. The message got through, and they were scared. So Avimelech called Avraham, and he said to him, now he's angry. What did you do to us, and what did I sin against you, that you brought upon me and my kingdom such a terrible sin? Things that I've just not done, you've done with me. I mean, who does these kind of things? You don't do things like this. You don't go into a country with your wife and say it's your sister and then set up a situation where we can all get wiped out. Adultery. And Abimelech said to Abraham, what did you see that you did this? What did you see? Why did you do it? Now this becomes very complex. And Abraham said, for I said, behold, but only there is no fear of God in this place. And they'll kill me for the matter of my wife. That's answer number one. And also, she really is my sister. The daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother. And she was my wife. Now, this sounds very strange. Well, what do you mean she's your sister? Mm-hmm. So it's like a half-truth, it sounds like. What do you mean? In what sense is she's not your sister? In other words, like this. He really was, Sarah was his niece, was the daughter of his brother, his niece. That's been brought down to us before. So how does this become my sister? I married my sister. So he's defending himself. He says like this. She is my sister, the daughter of my father. And he says, and a daughter is permitted to the Noahite. In other words, according to the Noahite code, which was in effect at that time, a person could marry his daughter. I'm sorry, sister. I got it all wrong. Sister. Okay. Basav, right. The daughter of one's father, Muteris Leben Noah. Yeah. No? No. Believe it? Can't believe it. Can't believe it. Take a look at Rashi. You have Rashi? Okay. Take a look at Rashi. On your day. Achosi bas avihi. Ubas av. The daughter of a father, Muteres Leben Noach. Right. But one second. Slow down a second. Why? What's the end of that, Rashi? She ain't avos laknani. Because there's no fatherhood for a Canaanite. There's no fatherhood. The institution of father doesn't exist. So therefore, there's no relationship. She's not truly a sister. What difference would it make then? You mean there is motherhood?
There is motherhood.
Okay. Anyways. But the point of it is, it wasn't really, first of all, it's not true though. Because it wasn't his father's daughter. She was not his sister. That's not the truth. That is not the truth. Ah. Okay. So then Rashi says, he said this in order to show, to verify his words that he wasn't lying. It wasn't an official lie. And he says, it isn't if you ask, but she was the daughter of his brother. She was the daughter of his brother, not the daughter of his father. So he says, well, b'nei banim harein t'banim. That is to say, grandchildren are like children. And therefore, she is the daughter of Terah. So how does it work? His father was Terah. And Sarah was the granddaughter of his father. You can follow this. So therefore, if we say that a granddaughter is a daughter, right? So therefore, she was really the daughter of Terah. She was really the daughter of Terah. So she's really, in a sense, it's not a lie to say she's my sister. It's kind of convoluted, but if you accept all of his reasoning, it turns out that I'm really not lying. I'm really not lying. Then he gives his third answer. He gives three answers over here. And it was when God caused me to wander from the house of my father. In other words, I've been a wanderer for a long time now since I left my native land. So I said to her, this is the compassion that you'll do for me. Wherever we go, please say you are my sister. So that's his third answer. Seems to be three, each one seems to be nullifying the other one. Because what is it? Is it because there's no fear of God in this place?
So that's why, so I lied to you, but I did it because he's saying, the first answer is saying, look, I lied to you because you guys are a bunch of low-level people and there's no fear of God in this place. I had no choice. That's the answer. Secondly, the answer is I really didn't lie to you because everything has been 100% true because she really is my sister. And the third answer is that, well, this just has nothing to do with you. It has nothing to do with you. It's a story that was made up, but it was made up a long time ago because we started to go on travels and we had to go into all kinds of crazy places. So we decided this will be our cover story. Okay. So Avimelech apparently is very pleased with this because he says Avimelech took sheep and calves and servants and maidservants and gave them to Abraham. So Abraham's getting extremely wealthy. This boy has worked twice now because he leaves. Pharaoh gave him tremendous gifts. And now Avimelech gives him tremendous gifts. And returned to him his wife Sarah. And then Avimelech said, behold, my land is before you. Wherever is good in your eyes, you can settle. Now notice a distinction between this and in the case of Pharaoh kicked him out. Pharaoh didn't want any part of him. Get out. Avimelech is welcoming, wants him to stay. That's an important distinction. And then to see, pacify Sarah. And he says, behold, I've given 1,000 pieces of gold to your brother. To your brother. He uses the term brother. Okay. Let it be to you a covering of the eyes. In other words, let this sort of cover all the hurt or whatever hurt you've gone through. He wants to pacify her. Right. That's right. As Rashi points out, she shouldn't feel like she's being treated. In other words, if he just gave her back without any gifts, it would look like she was being mistreated, like she was worthless. So forth. And then it says that Avram prayed to God. Now Avram prayed to God, and God healed Avimelech and his wife and his servants, that they were able to now conceive and have children. For God had closed up all of the wombs in the house of Avimelech because of the matter of Sarah, the wife of Avram, which means to say that was the plague. That all the wombs were closed, they couldn't conceive, and so forth. Now, what are some of the questions that we have to raise over here? If we compare this story to the story of Abram and Pharaoh, we have a number of questions. Jackie, you want to start? Okay, very good. Now, one difference is that Jackie said, in the case of Pharaoh, there was no vision. There was no dream. There was no message. Pharaoh was just smitten. And there was no communication. So why is it that Pharaoh was just smitten? But God didn't smite. Well, He did smite Avimelech. But in addition to that, God appears to him and communicates to him in a dream of the night. Okay, that's another question. Another question that we left off with last week is that Compare in chapter, what's the first story? 12. It's almost identical, but Pharaoh confronts Abraham over there too, right? It says that Pharaoh called Abraham and said, what is it that you did to me? Why did you tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, that I took her to me for a wife? And now here's your wife, take her and leave. Now, why didn't Abraham answer him? Abraham did not make any attempt to explain any of the answers that he gave. Yet, over here, the first question of Avimelech seems to be pretty similar. He says to Abraham, what did you do to us, and what did I sin against you that you brought upon me and my kingdom, a great sin? Things that are not done, have you done to me? And then he goes on. And in this case, Abraham answers him, and he answers him at length. Because when the Torah devotes three whole sentences to an answer, that's pretty significant. The Torah is very concise, very brief. So why did Abraham, one second, why? I just want to get the questions out. We'll take the answers. Let's get all the questions out first. Okay, next question, Lori. It's a good observation. Lori observed that in both cases, gifts were exchanged, and they were pretty similar. But notice the difference. In the case of Pharaoh, the gifts are given at the beginning, before he takes Sarah. In the case of Avimelech, no gifts are given at the beginning, but they are given quite at the end when he's returned.
Okay, well, you're giving the answer.
Oh, I don't know.
Yeah, let's just... Yeah, I know, but let's just... Okay, I just want the question, Joey, because once we get the underlying feature, perhaps that'll everything will fall into place. So I just want to note the problem. That's another good problem. I'm afraid is because they knew that this they were involved as well. They were... They knew, they understood enough to know that when there's something wrong, apparently there was some sin going on. They may not have understood it fully. And that when God does punish, it's not going to be restricted just to the king, but to all those who support him as well. So they saw that the whole kingdom is facing a catastrophe as a result of this dream, which they took very seriously. Okay, okay, Jackie?
Well, another question is, God seems to agree,
but not completely. Okay, that's something I wanted to point out. Because in the dialogue between Abimelech and God, Abimelech defends himself, and God seems to be conceding his point. Because God is saying, I do know that with innocence of heart did you do this. And I have exonerated you from sinning to me. Therefore, I didn't allow you to touch her. But God is saying, I've been looking out for your interest. This plague is really for your benefit, preventing you from doing this thing. However, Rashi points out something. I think it's what Jackie is referring to. Rashi points out something. Because notice that Abimelech used two statements. He said, innocence of heart and clean hands. Two statements. But when God answered him, God said, yes, innocence of heart, but not clean hands. God did not agree with him on clean hands. And Rashi makes a point of that. And Rashi says that... Rashi says, right. Rashi says, true that you did not intend from the beginning to sin. But cleanliness of hands, we don't have it. So you acted with innocence of heart, but not with clean hands. That's exactly what I'd like to know. So what does it mean? You're innocent of heart, but you've got dirty hands. Now, what does that mean? Let's translate that. I'm sorry? You're innocent, you have good intentions, you're right, but you don't have clean hands. What do I mean by that? They seem to go hand in hand. Yeah. Very good. Also, another difference is that in the case of Pharaoh, God does not require that Pharaoh go to Abraham and have Abraham pray for him. So if God's objective was the same, was simply to save Sarah from the clutches of Abimelech, so why didn't God just give him the ultimatum? And either he lets her go or doesn't let her go. But it wasn't enough for him just to let Sarah go. Right? Because God says in verse 7, now on the Abimelech story, God says, I now return the wife of the man, for he is a prophet, that he pray for you and you live. So in other words, in order for Abimelech to be saved, he had to do two things. For Pharaoh to be saved, he only had to do one thing. Let Sarah go. That's all he had to do. For Abimelech, he had to do two things. He had to let Sarah go, and then he had to have Abraham pray for him. Now why is God making it more stringent or demanding for Abimelech? Well, you see from this tough question, now what we're going to try and do is find a key. Where would you say, which sentence, let's go step by step.
Most important thing?
Yeah, which sentence provides the key to an understanding of Abimelech? That's a good question. Another good question. The commentary asked this question. Why does the fact that he's a prophet have to do with it? And what if he wasn't a prophet? You mean, no, you're right. You're 100% right. They all fall in line. We have to focus, first of all, see if you can find out, what would you consider of all the sentences, of all the verses in the Abimelech story, which one is the most significant in terms of giving us an insight into breaking open the whole story? And also, I think everybody's, not that it's your fault because we've run a lot of material with you, but I think that we've sort of forgotten about those Rashis where he mentions, where Abimelech is mentioning about the fact that God wasn't just in terms of the Doha Mabel by destroying the generation. What does that have to do with anything? How does that finish the picture? So we're going to try and get some kind of a picture over here, form some kind of a concept. The question then is, they were lacking the fear of God. the Pharaoh was also apparently lacking in the fear of God, although he had a superstitious fear of God. They didn't have, what I want then is if we can create a concept of the nature of this society on the basis of the fact that only lacking in fear of God. And why is it that since they're only lacking in fear of God, everything should be able to fit into place? Okay, Jackie?
He was intelligent.
And right. You mean they weren't functioning rationally?
No.
Then how could they be intelligent?
So
what kind of intelligence? No, but then according to this, if that were the case, if they were just lacking in rationality, then the critique should not have been the absence of fear of God. The critique should have been the absence of rationality. There's no fable.
Well, no,
they were that. Maybe I'm misunderstanding you. My question is like this. My question is like this. I think we're all on the track, but I'm not going to make it that easy. On the track for one second. If we're going to assume now you're putting Abimelech on a very high level. If that is the case, though, if he is on such a high level, and he is a moral person, he functions according to rational systems, so why can you say, this is my wife? What Abimelech was arguing is saying that had I known this, I wouldn't do this. And God is confirming it by saying, yes, I know you have an innocent heart. We wouldn't have known that. No. Hold on a second. God is confirming, one second. If it is true, let's put it this way. Oh, hold it a second. If it was true, one second. If it was true that Abimelech is really correct, and that he's on a very high moral level, but he doesn't have a divine system, he has his own system, he's on a very high level. Saying is like this, if it is really, the way I'm interpreting the story, maybe you don't agree with me. I'm interpreting the story that Abraham was justified in what he did. God is backing him up. Now, if that's the case, if it is true that Abimelech was on a level where he had worked out his own system, and that according to his system of morality, he never would dream of taking a married woman, and there was really no need for Avram to make up this story, except Avram didn't know. But in reality, there was no need for him to make up the story, and why should Abimelech have to go through this torture and everything? He's really innocent. And God did not. In fact, Avram should apologize. He shouldn't give him gifts. But the whole story should come out differently. It should be Abraham who's apologizing to Abimelech and saying, in other words, God should have come to Abraham then. God should have come to Abraham in a vision of the night and say, this is wrong. This man is a righteous person. He may not follow my morality, but he has his own morality. And he's a righteous person. And go to him and tell him that she is your wife and he'll return her. If that's the case, the story should have had a different ending. The story should have ended with Avram going to Abimelech and telling him the truth and Abimelech returning Sarah. But it didn't work out that way. So apparently it wasn't as simple. It wasn't that simple. There was a danger there. Avram, in the end, seems to be justified. There's not clean hands. That's what I'm trying to get at. But I want to give... Well, we said... Hold it a second. We said like this. She's right. David is right because there's another Rashi. I didn't mention it yet. I was saving it. Rashi doesn't. You see, Rashi is very suspicious of Abimelech. Rashi is not so sympathetic to Abimelech as you seem to be. Rashi, when he says surely, I said surely or but only. There's no fear of God. The Rashi comments like this: when a guest comes to the city, they ask him about matters of food and drink, right? But do they ask him about his wife? Is she, in other words, do they ask him about his wife? Who is this woman? Is she a wife? Is she a sister? In other words, what he's saying is like this: that when he came in, he passed through customs, so certain things you expect to be questioned on. But they showed too much interest in this woman. Who is she? In other words, he noticed, so it wasn't just a question that he's... Right, he did notice. He noticed that by the questioning, by the questioning that there was an excessive amount of interest in an area where you shouldn't be so interested. What's it their business? I'm just coming here to do some business. What do you care who this woman is? There was an excessive amount of interest. After Noisha Bola here, a guest comes to the city. Al Iske Achilu Ushtia Shaolan Oso? Do we ask him about matters of food and drink? Oh, Al Iske Ishtu Shaolan Oso? Or do we ask him about his wife? In other words, which is the right one? Ishtu, your wife, she's your wife or sister? It's in a question form. In other words, you ask about food and drink. You don't ask about the wife. What do you guys do? You ask about the woman. That's what
I'm saying. They ask you the one or the other.
No.
So, no, either they ask you about food and drink or they ask you about your wife,
In other words, the implication is that there's a proper line of questioning and improper line of questioning. Right? The guys at the immigration, they have a right to ask certain questions. But personal business, I would say like this, that we're pretty much on the mark. There's the essential difference between Egyptian societies. The Egyptian society was essentially an essential society. And of course there was a thin veneer of conscience or superego. It was basically self-serving, but it was out in the open. The society of Avimelech was a high-level society. It was very sophisticated. In other words, it means that they had sublimated their emotions, and they were on a high intellectual level. The proof that they were on a high intellectual level is the very fact that God communicated. God, as we know, in a dream, that's a very high level. And God would not, that's why God did not communicate with Pharaoh. Pharaoh was simply treated as an object, a problem to be dealt with. But to get him to disgorge Pharaoh had to be through pain. That's it. But God didn't communicate with him. Now, another proof that he was not on an intellectual level is that Abraham didn't answer. His questions were just an expression of his anger. They're just emotional questions, and therefore there's no point. And that's another reason why God did not force him to go to Abraham. All he had to do to save his life was to give up Sarah. But God did not command him to go to Abraham. Why? Because there was nothing he could learn from Abraham. Because he wasn't interested in learning anything. Because he was just a lustful and sensual person. And that's also proven by the fact that he had to, in order to present any problem, he had to get him out of the country because he couldn't trust the people over there. Somebody else would take up with Pharaoh. Now, Avimelech was a very, very interesting character. He was a intellectual. He was on a high level. However, he lived according to a code, morality. He lived according to ethics. And they had a very sophisticated culture of which he was very, very proud. Except there was one thing which was missing. There was one thing that was missing. And what was that? It was based purely on their own rationality, but it was not based upon subservience to the divine system of ethics. And here the Torah is teaching us something, that the difference between man-made ethics and between divine ethics. And what's the essential difference over here? That's why he says, because Avram does explain. In other words, Avram is not just saying, I didn't know, and I couldn't take a chance. He could have said that. He said, look, I don't know the nature of society, what I'm coming to. He said, I do know. I know that there's no fear of God in this place. And if there's no fear of God in this place, then I will not trust my life. I will not give myself over into the hands of a society which has a system of morality, but it's purely humanitarian. It's purely mandate. Why is that? What is that element of fear of God? Yes? But there's no yet. There's no year as old as him. Okay, that's a good question. Yeah. In other words, see, the thing is like this, that you see that they had an attitude of rebelliousness against God. So the entire culture that they had was based upon their own pride and their own ego and their own ability to work out a system. It was a man-made system. Now, any man-made system is subjective. It's very subjective because everybody feels he has a code, like a morality. And then each person feels that he knows exactly what's right and what's wrong. And you may not be able to justify it, but you see that people get into all kinds of arguments. That's wrong. To behave that way in this situation is wrong. And but what you should do, you should act this way. You know, you see, people they're very attached to their own sense of what's right and wrong. Everybody has a very, like abortion. There's no objective, exactly. There's tremendous wars, tremendous battles that you study, they're ready to kill. I'd more for an ideal. For abortion. Or for the right to abortion. They'll kill pro-life, but I'll kill you. Without saying, the thing is like this, really, and then you listen to the arguments, even the arguments aren't that, you know, you'd imagine that people are ready to go, that they really have very, very powerful, none of the arguments are convincing. It's just that since you believe in this position, so you choose these arguments. Same thing with capital punishment. See, the Torah holds that there's really no way that man by himself can decide these issues. Because we just don't know. Because how can you know? The whole question of abortion. Of a system from God, then he just has to admit that he's ignorant. Or whatever position he's following is just his own emotion. So, that is the... You see, that was the flaw. The flaw in their system was that they had an overestimation of their own rationality, of their own ability. Now, of course, Judaism is a rational system, because we believe that the Torah, the laws that God has given to us are intelligible, are intelligent, are rational. But they're not things that are so easily and readily apparent to us. It takes a tremendous amount of study. And it's based upon God's infinite knowledge. And in fact, there are many things in the Torah that we may not understand. The fact that we don't understand it doesn't mean that it's not rational. In the same way that there are many things a doctor prescribes in medicine, you don't understand how it works, but you take it because you know the source. This is a person who has a greater understanding. This is what troubled Abraham. See, Abraham was troubled by the fact that they were operating in a system which was based upon their own innate sense of what's right and what's wrong, and that is really subject to a tremendous amount of rationalization. And you're functioning in that system, it's very easy to deceive yourself, to fool yourself. Because in that situation, when you have a tremendous desire, when you have a tremendous attraction, since it's a man-made system, it's very easy to rationalize. However, when you're operating in a different system, and that is to say that it's not your own laws, but there's a subservience to the creator of the universe, and you live in the framework of following the system of God, oh, of course, I mean, there's no, as long as you have free will, you can still sin. We're not saying that there's, but that's a different kind of society. I can trust that person. Because that person, if the person has a genuine conviction, the very nature of a conviction, if a person is genuinely honest, and he's conforming to a divine system, then this person functions according to certain absolutes. Then I can trust him. In that situation, warrants trust. But I cannot have trust in a society which has not entirely given up all of their sensual desires. They were a sophisticated society. They enjoyed, for example, in other words, in Egypt, it was overt sexuality. But I'm sure in this society it wasn't overt, but they had beautiful art. It was sophisticated. Maybe pictures of beautiful women. So that's not the pornography, that's art. They had sublimated. They still indulged their sexual desires, but they did so in a sublimated way. That came out. That's why he's saying, Tum Lavavi, innocence of heart. Innocence of heart means, as far as you could see, you didn't have an evil plan, but not cleanliness of hand. Because cleanliness of hand means to say that that your desires in these areas had been completely redirected, had been completely removed. That's not true. You're still partook of these things. You overestimated yourself. That was you rebelled against God. You overestimated yourself. And I sensed that when I came into the country. I sensed that this country overestimated itself. They're on a high level, but they should have had a little humility. They should have had some humbleness. And instead, because I could sense that they had an excessive interest in this woman. So they still did partake of sexual desire. But they themselves would never admit it because they were on too high a level. I can't trust such society. They would find a way. Since it's a man-made... What? Okay. So what I'm trying to say is like this, is that the whole point then, you see, the whole point of the encounter, God didn't hold him accountable.
God wanted him to have a conversation, to learn from others. Because he was an individual who had the potential to raise himself to a higher level of ethical and moral behavior, to learn about the God of the universe. To correct, he did have certain, it's not clear exactly what his relationship with God is, other than the fact that he had certain complaints about God's justice. He had a problem in that area. So the reason why that he could go to Abraham and Abraham would pray for him was because he wanted him to have this dialogue with Abraham. As a result of this dialogue, he raised himself to a higher level. Abraham taught him, see, the Torah doesn't express this openly, but Abraham taught him a whole new concept of God. And as a result of this, that's when he gave the presents. See, he gave the presents. Yeah, of course. Well, later on, I'll tell you, we'll see later on. It says later on that when he made a party, when his son Yitzchak was weaned, so he made a party. So it says, Mishta Gadol, a great party. Wasn't so rocket, wasn't it a great party? He invited the great people of the generation. It was Shem and Avimelech. So according to Rashi, Avimelech emerged as a great, he calls him a Gadol Hador, a great man of the generation. So the purpose of this story was to really was intended for the benefit of Avimelech. Avimelech, the reason why it wasn't enough for him to just release Sarah was because that wasn't the point. The point was to learn. It was a learning experience. To learn the ideas, the true ideas of ethics and morality, which was based upon the only true, the system that is like this, the only true ethics and morality is that which comes from God. Because anything which is man-made, it's simply, underneath it all, it's based upon a human whim. It's based upon a human emotion. No matter how rational, there are just certain issues which it is impossible from a human perspective to decide in an objective way. So what it boils down to is how you feel about something. But how you feel about something has nothing to do with objective reality. And ultimately, the only true morality is that which is based upon objective reality, which comes from the Creator. And if a person doesn't have that, so basically he's functioning according to his own whims. So even if he's very sophisticated, and even if he has an allegiance to rationality, he's dangerous, because the situation will come along where there is a conflict between the system of morality and his own emotional desires. In that situation, he will rationalize. But the person who has a fear of God has a greater advantage. I'm not saying he can't become corrupt, because you'll ask, well, what about all these religious people that become corrupt? He too can become corrupt, but he has greater fortification. He's got a greater foundation, because his knowledge of God will, his knowledge of God and also his sense of certainty that he's dealing in the realm of the absolute and not just in a human construct, not just in a human projection, gives him a greater advantage. And that's why Avram said to him, sure, I only saw one thing, that you're on a very high level. You're on an extremely high level. But you're lacking one element. And because of that element, I couldn't take any chances. I can't go into all the dialogue over here. Maybe that's for a different time. But I think that's the essential difference between the two societies. So I'll stop at this point and take some questions. Please stay with me for one more second. And that is, take a look at the way the question is. In verse 9, look inside your chumash. Please look inside your chumash. I want to point out something. In verse 9, Avimelech called Avram and said to him, what did you do to us, and what did I sin against you, that you brought upon me and my kingdom a great sin? Things that are not done, you've done with me. Abraham didn't answer that question. That was the same type of question that Pharaoh had asked him. That was just an outburst of his emotion. Then that was just an outburst. Yeah, I know that, but I'm just talking in this context. You see, then the father says, and Avimelech said, this is a new statement, because it's introduced with, and Avimelech said to Avram, which means this is an entirely new statement. What did you see? Now, you see, now he's gotten out, he let him get his emotions out, he let him express his anger. Don't talk to a person when there's no point. Then, when he says, you calm down, he says, tell me, I want some insight into myself. Explain to me, what do you know about my emotional structure? What's wrong with me? What's my problem? Nera Isa, what did you see? Ah, then, when he saw that Avimelech is genuinely interested in understanding, then he began to explain to him, I said, there's no fear of God.